book of Samuel, chapter 1, verse 1, and then verses 17 to 27. And it's on page 304 in the church Bibles. After the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and lived in Ziklag for 2 days. David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. It is written in the book of Jashar. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. O mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain, nor fields that yield offerings of grain. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, the sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
This morning's gospel comes from Mark chapter 5. Reading verses 21 to 43, and can be found on page 1007 of the Church Bibles. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered round him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. And yet, instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I will be healed." Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "You see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. He went in. Is that right? Why bother the teacher anymore? Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Good morning. Well, as you realise, I've decided not to robe this morning because it is just too hot. So I've just put my little scarf around my neck. Okay. Well, the gospel reading this morning gives us one of those two-for-one deals that we like to find in the shops, because we find one story sandwiched inside the beginning and the end of the other. And they're presented like this because each story interprets the other. They need to be considered together. And just like with these apples on the screen, though, there are significant similarities and differences between them. So taking the differences first, we have very different approaches to Jesus and a difference in the status of the characters. In the first story, it's Jairus who is named and who was one of the leaders of the local synagogue, would have been a prominent figure, who makes quite a bold approach to Jesus and does so with a respectful request. And this is in stark contrast with the unnamed woman in the second stories, who sneaks a touch of Jesus's robe without asking. So two differences, but many similarities. In both, the person who receives the healing is unnamed. We don't know the identity of the woman who was bleeding, neither do we know the name of the girl. In both, the person who is healed is ritually unclean. In Jewish law, two of the chief threats of impurity was contact with a dead body and touching people who had bodily discharges, particularly associated with menstruation. And it's notable that this story comes directly after the healing of the Gerasene demoniac, who would also have been considered unclean. In both, we have the picture of the crowds clamouring around Jesus for his attention and putting pressure on him. And the time span of 12 years is repeated as well. The lady has been bleeding for 12 years and the little girl is 12 years old. And she's referred to as a little girl, though of course in their culture at 12 she would have been nearly old enough to marry. But one has been bleeding since the other was born. But perhaps the most significant similarity to be drawn between them, and one from which we can all learn today, is that they both deal with faith and fear. And the problem is, we live in a culture, don't we, that's permeated with fear. You only have to look at how certain newspaper publications deliver their news to see how the focus is always on bad news. My daughter was complaining about this just yesterday. It's always talking about the threat of terrorist activity, the rise in gun and knife crime, the inadequacies of our health and social care provision, and how everything, all society's ills, can be blamed on immigration. I could go on. But fear in these situations leads to paranoia and mistrust of the media, of the police, of our doctors and social services, of our politicians, of our neighbours. The list is endless. And if we're not careful, That way of thinking can permeate the church too. But we have a choice in the way we respond. We can respond with fear or with faith. And at this time in our church family, we are living through testing times. We are in a time of transition, minding the gap between the end of Simon's ministry and the start of the next chapter in our lives together. To borrow Steve's idea, we're in Interregnum 3 now, awaiting news of who our new vicar will be, wondering when they will start and what changes they will bring. And not only have we lost Simon and Heather, of course, but we'll also be losing that group of individuals who will move to St. Richard's with them to support them after July the 11th. And as we mind this gap, we face very real and significant challenges, because these folks are going to leave enormous holes in some of our rotas, and you'll see a notice about that on our green sheets today. And it's up to each and every one of us to respond to these challenges, because we can do so with faith or with fear. So let's see what these stories can teach us. So fresh from healing the Gerasene demoniac, which must have left Jesus physically and emotionally exhausted, he crosses over to the Sea of Galilee, only to find the crowd gathering round him again. And the story starts with Jairus, a leader of the local synagogue, who falls at Jesus' feet and begs him repeatedly, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." Now, Jairus would have had some standing within the local community. He would have been treated with a degree of respect. When he spoke, people will have listened. He would have been responsible for organizing the worship in the local synagogue. He would have looked after the building and overseen the running of the school. And synagogue leaders would also have been quite close to the Pharisees. And they were more than a little upset about what Jesus was doing already. So it's quite likely that Jairus may have been lent on by them and come under pressure not to support this Jesus, to be wary of him, to keep his distance from him and distrust him. But all that goes out the window when his daughter's dying. He forgets his pride, he forgets his fears, he doesn't care about what his friends or what the Pharisees might say, and he throws himself at Jesus' feet. And it really is hard to convey just how undignified those who were watching would have considered his behaviour to be. But after he blurts out his request, Jesus goes with him, with the crowd again following. He shows true humility, and Jesus responds. And I think there's a lesson in that for us as well. But it's at this point that the second story interrupts the account. In the crowd, moving through the streets of Capernaum, there's this woman, a bold woman, who dares to draw near to Jesus without a male sponsor. A woman whose condition, as we have noted, would have made her ritually unclean. Extraordinary courage would have been needed for her in her social situation to act as she did, knowing what the reaction of the crowd might be if she were discovered. For the previous 12 years, she's been cut off from society. She's been financially ruined, and she's been badly treated by the medical practitioners. But, you know, perhaps being perpetually unclean, perhaps she'd come to the end of herself, and perhaps she had no choice but to act as she did. And her faith in who Jesus is seen by her belief that not only touching him, but even touching his clothes might provide her with the healing that she needed so desperately. And immediately after that touch, she recognizes a change in her body. She knows that her bleeding has dried up. But just as the woman understood the changes in her body, so too Jesus understood a change in his. The drying up of her blood flow was due to, if you like, a discharge of his power. Now, at this point, nobody knows what's happened. The disciples don't, and not even Jesus knows. He's not fully aware of what's happened. But he's unwilling to let this discharge of his power go without acknowledgement. So who touched my clothes, he asks. Now, given these circumstances, this woman could have just quietly disappeared into the crowd without saying anything. She'd got the healing that she came for. But if her faith had created a channel through which Jesus' healing power could flow, she had shown faith, but at this point she is still fearful. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. And it's at this point that Jesus' words give her more than she could ever have imagined. She's no longer just a woman, but she's claimed as a daughter, one whose faith has made her well. She receives Jesus' grace and is able to leave in peace. And almost as an afterthought, she receives the confirmation that she's been healed of her disease. But if hope is running high at this point, it comes crashing down again as we return to the first story to hear the news that Jairus' daughter has died. Why bother the teacher anymore? But Jesus won't let this sense of hopelessness win out. Don't be afraid, he says, just believe. You know, this is the only story in any of the Gospels. It is repeated in Luke, but it's the only story where this crucial link between faith and fear is spoken out so clearly by Jesus. But the problem for Jairus, as for us very often, is that when people tell us, don't be afraid, it's too late. We're often, all 9 times out of 10, we're already eaten up with fear. And to think of faith in moments like that is difficult. It takes a conscious effort. But, you know, in Jesus we have one who is able to transform our fear into faith. And what he's really saying is here is, stop being afraid. Go on living by faith. Keep on believing. And we know the rest of the story, of course. The crowd proceed through the streets of Capernaum to Jairus' house, where he throws out all the professional mourners who were crying and wailing, and no doubt, much to the amusement of the crowd, announces that the child isn't dead, but asleep. It's only the child's parents and the 3 closest disciples who go into the child's room, where he speaks these words over her. Talitha cum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. And the scene closes with him demanding that no one speak about what they've seen, because what he was doing would have been viewed as subversive and dangerous by the authorities. And then we get that lovely eyewitness detail where he tells the parents to go and get her something to eat. And that's complete holistic care. These words, Talitha cum, are very special to me personally. Last year at the New Wine Summer Conference, on the Tuesday afternoon, I went to a seminar led by a lady called Kate Coleman about empowering women. Now, this is not an excuse for all the men in the congregation to switch off at this point, because I think what she said is equally valid for all of us. But Kate spoke about the difficulties she'd faced in ministry and leadership, how she'd struggled with her studies, with her finances, and eventually she'd gone to a much older and respected colleague, and she just poured her story out to him. And she said that he left a long silence, and then when he did respond, he just said 2 words to her, Talitha cum. Little girl, get up. And I just had an inkling in that moment that there was something in those words for me as well. And we didn't discuss it, but after the seminar, that was confirmed when Fiona said exactly the same thing to me. You see, as Christians, we all go through difficult times in our lives. We all face challenging times, and it's tempting at times like that to protect ourselves by nurturing the child within. I've got at home a set of Russian dolls. I've brought two of them with me. Because there are days when I feel like this one, the outermost doll, and I feel strong and confident and capable and ready to take on the world. But there are other days when I feel like this one, the smallest one. And I feel small and vulnerable and helpless. And when I feel like this, all I want is for someone to come up, put their arms around me, tell me it's all going to be okay and rescue me, kiss me and make it better, just like a child. It's quite true that there are occasions in our lives, traumatic and challenging times, when just to survive, we need to protect our inner child. But we shouldn't stay there, that's the point. There will also be a time when we need to grow up, to take responsibility. Maybe times when we need to give help rather than always seek to receive it. Times when we need to hear Talitha Kum, or whatever the male equivalent is. Little girl, little boy, get up. As I indicated earlier during this interregnum, St. Paul's is going to need folk to step up and help us through this difficult time. And we can't assume that someone else is always going to do it. And these stories also show us that God often chooses those whom society considers weak and looks down on to shame the strong. The demoniac, the diseased woman, and the dead girl were all unclean, yet Jesus gave them his healing power. In his ministry, Jesus repeatedly crossed gender, ethnic, and cultural boundaries. When he met people in need, he didn't leave them that way. Shouldn't our ministry also cross boundaries, whether they are related to ethnicity, gender, race, sexual orientation, politics, or any other boundary that divides our society? We need to bring that life-giving change to all. And finally, it also challenges us about how we respond when, as with the little girl, God doesn't seem to show up when we want him to. You know, so often we want him to fix our problems instantly. How is our trust when it doesn't happen like that? It may be that sometimes situations are allowed to progress in order that our faith may deepen. And often it seems that he only turns up after everything has gone wrong, only when we come to the end of ourselves, when we are like Jairus, desperate and fearful. It's only then that we can respond with faith. And I love this quote from Tom Wright, who says, "When life crowds in with all its pressures, there is still room for us to creep up behind Jesus, if that's all we feel we can do. And in that odd mixture of, and touch him, in that odd mixture of fear and faith that characterizes so much Christian discipleship." So whether, like Jairus, we're bold in our approach, or whether, like the woman, all we can do is creep up and sneak a touch of his cloak, we need to present our needs to Jesus in faith. It's his power that brings healing, but it's faith that gives a channel along which that healing can flow. And if we respond in faith, then our fears will dissipate. They will go. Because as John tells us, perfect love casts out fear. If we are not fearful, we can respond to this call on our lives. If a dead 12-year-old girl can respond, then surely so can we. The ministry of this church doesn't stop because we're in interregnum. We're not just marking time here. We too the little girls amongst us, the little boys amongst us, can all hear his call for us to get up, to be raised, to allow ourselves to become the people that he wants us to be.
So let's stand and declare our faith in God.